Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the editors and writers at strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, and your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com, and Austin Bay, author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Jim and Austin have just finished the fourth edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War. Jim, last week you wrote an article on the Iraq War is won, but nobody's noticed. What determines that we've won the war, or why have we won the war?
Well, the Department of Defense has a scoreboard, which is classified, unfortunately. But from what I've seen of it or heard of it, it consists of dozens of metrics, as they call it. In other words, things they can measure. Some are, you know, more definite than others. For example, dead bodies, weapons captured, i.e. roadside bombs going off, American casualties. And Austin, you worked with the geeks with guns, you know, the operations research cells when you were on duty over there. So you know something about this. They do have
what I can say about it is that it's an imprecise operations research, but it's got a quantitative component to it, and you just listed some of the statistics. It's when General Petraeus, it's not just General Petraeus, but some of the other spokespeople for multinational force and multinational corps talk about trying to determine local control, and local control could even be focused as tightly on just a series of neighborhoods, you know, a town in Anbar or Babil, and you could have an incident and said, hey, that wasn't controlled, but you compare it, it was a violent incident, people were killed, but you compare it, say, to conditions that existed 3 or 4 years ago, and you have one in a, whatever your measuring period is, say 28 days, 30 days, instead of having four.
What they do is use
those are the ways you do it.
Being an OR practitioner, let me put this in simple terms. They use what they call the aggregation, I guess you call it. That's a word most people can understand. They put a whole bunch of this data together, and they can get an overall statistic of, you know, which direction we're going in. But again, for operational purposes, not to let the enemy know how they're being measured or what we're looking at and what have you. So a lot of it contains classified information. Some of the data on, you know, terrorist operations, as one guy pointed out to me, says even Al-Qaeda doesn't know some of this stuff because we have a better big picture view. We have more sensors all over the place than Al-Qaeda Central does. So we know this. And as Austin was pointing out, with all that information, they can actually see if we're winning in specific places. For example, last month, no American soldier was killed in combat in Baghdad. First time that had happened, you know, since the invasion. That's one of the many metrics. So they have a definite idea, a number, as it were, a trend line. Let's put it that way. Think of it as a trend line. Of where we're going, and the one that made the biggest impression upon the media and civilians was the 80, or now it's 90% drop in deaths. Right. I mean, that many fewer Iraqis and Americans are being killed over the last year.
Well,
But there are many other things they are measuring, as Austin points out, measuring all kinds of terrorist operations, like people coming across the border, captured weapons, captured ammunition, and stuff like that.
Now, I have a question for Austin on this.
Well, let me add something on this. A lot of this stuff, I don't want to leave the impression with listeners that it's all some big mystery and the like. Just take a look. I mean, and this is completely open source. I'm not speaking from any particular secret or esoteric knowledge on this. Ask a police chief how he determines effectiveness of his own police patrols. They're going to have some measure that has a quantitative basis to it, incidents reporting. Some of it's going to be qualitative. And he will have, when I say it's qualitative, he's got a sergeant who has worked for the police force for 23 years, knows, and let's say it's one of the more difficult neighborhoods in his town. The sergeant knows who the business people are. He knows who the constant complainers are. He knows who the cranks are, and he knows a heck of a lot about some of the local criminals. Now, his opinion is qualitative. It's his opinion, but it's an opinion that is informed by a great deal of experience. And all this is coming from, these are the way that these assessments are made. But as Jim says, on the whole, you get an aggregation, and then you get a trend in the same way the Dow Jones Industrial Average is a measurement of a lot of different stocks, and it gives you a trend. Doesn't tell you necessarily what the future is going to be like, but it is a trend indicator.
I think probably the most important indicator is the New York Times did a couple of stories pointing out that, gee, things are awfully quiet in Baghdad and Iraq these days, without saying anybody won anything.
What Jim is pointing out there is the press critics and media critics, the silence of the critics, not just picking on the New York Times.
That's another metric of victory.
There's a metric. There is a metric, and that one, and I think Jim's right on that. That's one that speaks. Its silence speaks loudly, Dan.
Right.
Yeah. Now, when they stop reporting the war, we've obviously won.
Right. One of the things that I have been interested in throughout the war, and it's something that I want Austin to address, is that almost half of the casualties last month, there were only 14, were non-hostile. And even if we had these kids in a peacetime army, we would be having casualties, because when you give...
Oh, we have more casualties. I mean, for example, right, there were, I think, many more fatalities from motorcycle accidents in the armed services last year than there were from suicides.
Right. I went back and looked at the statistics for the Clinton years, and we were killing more people. Of course, the Army and the Air Force and the Navy were much larger then, but we were killing more people in accidents than...
Well, even if you adjust for that, the military was about, 60% larger during the 90s. Well, no, during the 90s, maybe 50%. But the deaths were something like 2,000 a year. So even if you adjust for the difference in size, you had about 1,200, 1,300, deaths a year. You still have close to 1,000 deaths a year. That's something people don't pay attention to because it's normal. Hey, it's a dangerous business. But it is more dangerous than just about any other occupation because you're dealing with, dangerous stuff. However, the accident rate in the military has come way down in the last 20 years. That's not news, but, it's very important for the guy who hasn't got a broken back or a missing arm or is dead, because of an accident with military equipment. Again, that's something that doesn't get reported, but so the lower casualty rate in combat is part of a larger trend.
Austin,
let me talk about it from a qualitative aspect, Dan. I think that's why you kind of directed that at me, or my own experience. This is something that is a fact of life. I think Jim has described that well in the military. It's a fact of life in any job involving heavy equipment, in any job involving a great deal of flying. There's a risk in it. Part of the reasons that the number of accidents and deaths and injuries have gone down since the mid-1980s, I think, is when you start that, is that volunteer army, a little bit older individuals, you've got a slightly older force, improvements in training, marginalization of drinking, alcohol consumption, has you can't say it's
random
down,
drug testing.
it's much
random
better,
drug testing.
Much better policed. The U.S. military has always focused on keeping people in shape, but really starting in the late 70s and early 80s, you had a focus on staying in. Keep it, well, for one thing, is we they would talk about the annual weigh-in for soldiers who were out of shape. You were either going to get in shape, or at some point you were going to be denied reenlistment, or you were going to be passed over for promotion if you were an officer. That has, and maybe it's a small statistical increase, but you put all that together, and it comes into the results that Jim was talking about, that fewer and fewer accidents. Still, you're dealing with here. One of the NCOs I served with in an armor outfit back in the 70s, there'd been an accident involving a tank turret, and a fellow had broken his arm in another outfit, and we were talking about it, and the sergeant said to me, he said, you know, these tanks, they're designed to kill. They don't care who they kill, is what his crack was. And you know, I asked him, I said, wow. He said, you know, they're talking about it. He says, oh, another NCO told me that line. He says, but it's true. I mean, look at you know, how dangerous they are, and you have to be aware all the time. And we have very strict standard operating procedures for mounting tanks and dismounting tanks. And sometimes, look, I described when I fell off of a tank in an ice storm, and it was extremely unpleasant. It was because there was ice on the top of the turret. I popped out and slipped right off of it. Those kinds of injuries in tough conditions are going to occur. But let's talk another thing about a little bit about the accidents too. Also look at the demographic. It's one reason why young men under the age of 25 are the highest risk in for insurers, you know, with cars. There are still incidents of speeding, and you read about the, you know, flipping a vehicle or the like, and that's where your pool of your soldiers come from, men between 19 and 25. But it's an aggressive risk taking group.
Yeah, the first time I ran across this was when I was told that the Marines, when they were in Vietnam, for the first 6 months, their death rate actually declined because they no longer had the Marines getting killed in automobile accidents with their cars and, you know, motorcycles, which they didn't have with them in Vietnam,
and they weren't in heavy combat yet. Trying to make there. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the trend, like as Austin points out, in the 80s you had the professional army, but also in the 70s and 80s there was a huge growth in better procedures for using equipment, better design for the equipment. Mm-hmm. So it was you could show troops how not to get hurt, and the equipment was more difficult. Was designed to make it more difficult to get hurt because, you know, tanks, you know, when I was in back in the 60s, there were accidents, you know, where they run over some guy, you know, they were out early in the morning and somebody didn't get the word that, hey, you're running through a bivouac area, and the sun's not quite up yet, and squash, you know, there goes another GI. Austin has a lot of experience with trying to drive a tank on icy roads. They slip and slide too, and you know, if they go down somewhere a bit, you know, people are gonna get banged up or killed. It's a very dangerous business, and there's no getting away from it, but they have made it a lot safer, and that has extended, you know, also to combat, believe it or not. There may be a book written about that one of these days, because eventually the media is going to wake up and realize that there was a huge breakthrough in reducing, you know, combat casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that certainly deserves a little bit of attention eventually.
Yes.
There was even a term that bounced around, and it's completely unofficial, but it actually describes very succinctly what Jim just said. It was called making equipment dummy proof.
Yeah,
well, there's nothing that's dummy proof, but the idea was that training procedures and design to lessen the likelihood of an accident. So.
Yeah, and take into account, even very intelligent people get the case of the dummies in the military, because sometimes you're up 24, 48 hours at a stretch.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're out there at 3 o'clock in the morning. That lowers your normal intelligence quite a bit. And you can do dumb things that you wouldn't normally do because you're simply, you know, not at the top of your game.
All right, but the back door to that, flip side of that is that's one of the reasons that you conduct training that, you're staying up 24
yeah.
to 36 hours so you can learn how you react and learn how you're going to make mistakes.
Know what you're going to be up against. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, and that's why are we practicing suffering is one of the lines that you might hear. Well, there are reasons. And there's an example is because, hey, if you've been up that long, you might be operating at 40% efficiency.
And, well, it's the same reason football teams, it's the same reason football teams practice full contact. Sure, you might lose some players, but you don't want them to get that for the first time in an actual game.
Absolutely.
Was it Frederick the Great, Jim, that he was upset that they were losing guys during exercises and the one of his generals said, in order to make omelets, you've got to break a few eggs?
Yeah, I mean, that goes, the Romans were a big, very much in favor of that. I think they were the ones who said, the more you sweat in peacetime, the less you bleed in wartime. But they also accepted, training losses as a necessary, evil if they were going to have the troops capable of fighting a battle and not getting, chewed to pieces.
Well, let's switch to another theater really quickly. I keep getting asked by people, why haven't we caught Osama yet? Why can't we catch the guy?
It's very simple. He's hiding out in a Pushtun area, probably on the Pakistan side of the border, and the Pakistanis, for any number of domestic political reasons, have not allowed us to go looking for him. And we've explained this in strategy base. That's amazing. I see some of the traffic on the listserv and on the message boards. People don't read the stuff we put out. In fact, the latest piece I think we posted today on Afghanistan, I go again into, explaining the reasons for all the violence in Afghanistan. It's a very violent place. It always has been. I went back, as many historians have, and have looked at the record. There is a record of the violence in Afghanistan, and it's terrible. It's always been a rough neighborhood. And the that particular, nastiness among many of the Pushtun tribes on the Pakistani side of the border has kept the Pakistani government out of that area. I mean, for example, after when Pakistan and India were created in 1947, up until that time, in the what they call the Northwest Frontier area, the tribal territories, as it were, there had never been any government law in that area. No law ever, as far as anybody could remember. And the British Raj government had a deal with the tribes. And the deal basically was, you don't raid into our territory, we won't mess with you. We'll trade with you, we'll let stuff go in and out. But, in effect, it was a long-term truce. And occasionally you read about punitive expeditions, when the Pushtun tribes, one band of them got out of line and raided, said, hey, I need some money. They're big on loot. And they went down into the lowlands and burned some villages and stole a bunch of stuff. The British were just obliged to send a couple of thousand guys up there to kill as many Pushtuns as they could find. And after that, it was all over until it happened again. So in 60 years, there's been no law in these border areas yet. The Pakistanis consider those areas as Pakistan national territory, which basically it is. Every part of the world except for Antarctica, somebody lays claim to. But in that particular area there, you had a unique situation. I don't know why the media didn't make more of this, because it's very exciting. It's cowboys and Indians, except the Indians are pale faces and they're much nastier. Osama could hide in there, because they are very religiously conservative, and they admire a guy who kills outsiders. Bin Laden goes in there with this reputation, with street cred, as they say, or hill cred over that part of the world. And he's honored. You know, they have that that custom of giving hospitality to guests, and of course he's an honored guest. So the Pakistanis don't want to go in and get him, but they are getting close now. They've been fighting all summer for about 3 months now, clearing out the three major strongholds of the pro-Taliban Pashtun tribes. So any day now there might be a, you know, an unexpected bulletin, unless you read Strategy Page, that hey, we've caught Bin Laden. But they would not let us go in, and until recently they would not go in. So that was basically the only place in the world where he could hide, with the possible exception of parts of Somalia. But even Al Qaeda doesn't like to hide out in Somalia.
You know, Austin, let me add
one word to what Jim said. Money. Money talks, and it even talks to tribespeople in the tribal areas. It talks everywhere. And I suspect, I have no proof, but I certainly have experience.
Well, actually, there is a lot of anecdotal evidence that Al Qaeda was free with the cash when they had to be.
I'm making a different distinction between what I could prove and the anecdotal talk, okay? And there is the anecdotal talk about how much money goes to protect Bin Laden. He's a source of income.
Yeah.
He's a source of cash. Now, he's a source of high risk. And at some point, there's that phrase, tipping point. Where's the tipping point if you're a tribe and you're just you're losing a lot of nephews and cousins and...
And this, here's this guy with a $25 million price tag.
It's not worth the money. Now you've gotten the money and whatever the deal. This sounds more cynical, but it's nevertheless it's equal part of the component in getting to Bin Laden, and He pays for his defense.
And you can buy your way in there. There was that guy who shot up the CIA entrance in Langley some years back and fled to Pakistan. He was apparently a Pashtun or whatever. Anyway, his father was a big shot, lived in a big walled compound. But the CIA was really intent on getting this guy, and they paid a lot of money to bribe enough people to grab him and bring him back. And he's sitting in a Supermax now. So you can do it, but, you know, this guy was not at Bin Laden's level in terms of, you know, what people were willing to take in order to flip him.
But as you
point out, eventually it's going to come to the point that says, well, maybe we should take the $25 million payday and just be done with this. We paid our dues.
That's not a new technique. Romans would do it. I give a talk in my strategy class about the Jurgentine War, and really how that's ended is relative father-in-law of Jugurtha gets a Roman bribe and essentially turns his son-in-law in. But
an offer he can't refuse, as the Italian
turns
like
his son-in-law becomes too big of a problem, and that's part of it, and that's not all the Romans were doing. I mean, they were had armies trapping around trying to chase Berbers. Well, it's tough chasing Berbers.
You know, what our listeners should remember, he says, if all of a sudden in the next year, 6 months, I'm sure George Bush is hoping in the next 2 months, all of a sudden Bin Laden is captured and the special forces and what have you, the U.S. government is rather vague on the circumstances, it's because they're trying to protect the people they're paying the $25 million to.
Oh, sure.
And that is, as part of that, there are probably several dozen green cards issued. And new people who don't speak English entering the witness protection program.
Anyway, and part of it is that we will be condemned by the Pakistani government, who benefits from Israel.
Right.
We'll be condemned by all kinds of people, and that's the surface level, the diplomatic condemnation. It'd be a little bit like our raid in Syria.
Well, that's right. In the back room, the Pakistanis, pat his hand on the back and saying, thank God you got rid of that beast.
Sure.
But that's the way it works over there, and you can't, as the old saying goes, you can't hustle the East.
That's right.
Dan, I know we're coming up on our half-hour time limit here. Look back to your question about how do we know we're winning in Iraq, and you,
okay.
Jim's article really does an excellent job of putting together the essentials on it. I'd point out, and I know we linked to it some time ago, but that piece I did for ArenaUSA.com on strategic overwatch, and of course I ended up doing a column, which we've got the column up in the on point section of strategypage.com, but talking about really where the trends were going and why you were going to begin to see U.S. troop withdrawals in 2009 following the trend line, because we'd won. And the other thing is, news of this success is suddenly that we're going to hear more and more about it over time as we get further away from the political utility, domestic political utility of using Iraq as a cudgel on the Bush administration. And you'll see where the roots of it lie in 2005 and 2006, even during the worst of the attempts by al-Qaeda and the Ba'athists to kill Shias and ignite a sectarian war. To some degree, they did ignite a sectarian war, as we've talked about on Strategy Page. But
and they lost.
a number of these lines of operation were having successes, even at that time. They just didn't get the coverage for it.
Right.
You know, there were a lot of failures, sure. But it's, like I said, it's much easier to cover a bomb explosion, oh, bad, than it is to look at somebody building a building with brick by brick, because the brick by brick's slow and it's not very sensational.
That's right. Not a lot of flash there.
You can't make a new story out of paint drying.
that's a good way to put it, too.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good place to end, gentlemen. Thank you this week, and we'll see you next time.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.